WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives. One moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. Sometimes, Jeffrey Essman wears an unsabot. Other times, he slips into a slinky satin dress, pops two pointy party hats into the top, and becomes Barbie, moaning over her lost Ken. And once in a while, he becomes a psychologist from Wisconsin, his homeland, pondering the inner angst of cows who come from good pastures. Usually, Jeffrey Essman performs off-Broadway, but today he's with us on Fresh Air. Well, actually, he's alone in a studio in New York talking to us through fiber optics. Which of your identities are we about to meet, Jeffrey?
A man named Clive, Lord Thatch Hewitt.
Okay.
Actually, as you meet him in the piece, he's waiting for an old school chum of his named Mr. Chesselton, or Chezzy, as he calls him. And as you find out earlier in the piece, they went to Cambridge together. They were childhood friends, though they fell out a bit when Chezzy got into anarchist politics. But as they continue over their discussion over tea, it also comes out that Clive has somewhat of a confession to make. Do you remember a boy named Devon Holmes? Yes, I believe they did call him Blondie. Actually, you met him once at the St. Ethelwold bonfire near Lindisfarne. Yes, the pantomime druid. Actually, I don't think you liked him much. Oh, no, it doesn't matter. Most people didn't. I never quite knew why. Well, I guess they thought him eccentric, what with his wrist corsages and all. You know, but that actually is what drew me to him. Devon could be so delightfully perverse. For example, he was a literature major. Well, there was nothing so strange in that, we all were. But Devon was actually majoring in American literature. Can you imagine? He was so marvelously queer. It was the American literature that started it all, really. He used to come to my rooms rather late at night, and we'd sit by the fire reading to one another. Oh, favorite bits of books, poetry, silly student stuff. He didn't sit in a chair, not Devon. No, he needed to be close to the earth, so he sat at my feet like a child being read a story or some pampered pet. I can still see him sitting there, the firelight dancing in that blonde hair of his pale hand on the page of his edition of Whitman. Yes, Walt Whitman. No, not the Civil War stuff, not us. If only we'd stayed as safe as the Civil War. No, it was something that went, I remember so well. Among the men and women, the multitude, I perceive one picking me out by secret and divine signs. Some are baffled, but that one is not. That one knows me. Well, I don't know what came over me, really. I mean, we'd always been quite fond of each other, quite close, but suddenly I was overwhelmed by the desire to touch him. I saw my hand go forward, almost as if it weren't my own, began stroking his hair so soft in the firelight. He didn't jump, didn't seem even to be startled, really, a small smile at the corner of his mouth as he continued reading. It all seemed quite natural at the time, quite beautiful. It went on that way for some months, the good part of the term, really. Every evening, the fire, the poetry, the stroking. Then one night, I remember so clearly, it was the week before summer holiday, I must have been thinking how I wasn't going to see him for months, but suddenly a force that was frightening, animal, drove my hand lower, and I began stroking the nape of his neck. Well, this time he did jump. There was a scene, an ugly one, and then we didn't see each other for 3 months. Oh, he spent the summer with an aunt down in Brighton, and Mother kept me busy with the annual Rose Festival for the cripples. The next term it seemed to be forgotten, or at least unmentioned. I was grateful enough for that. I concentrated on my work. I studied like a mad thing and actually thought I had put the whole thing behind me. Until one day I couldn't concentrate. They were doing some work on the garden below my rooms, and I could hear the gardener and his assistant going on in that lower-class dialect that I thought repelled me. I came to the window to ask them to lower their voices, and that's when I saw him. Toddy. Oh, a lower-class boy like any other, I suppose. Dirty cheeks, a general sense of untidiness. He looked up, and it was almost as if a secret understanding had passed between us. Instead of reprimanding him, I told him I needed some other work done. On flowers that only grew at night. He met me in the garden at the appointed time, 3 a.m, and again the animal force took over. I don't even remember speaking. I began stroking him at once, his hands, his arms, his shoulders, one night. Even his chest. So, there you have it. Lord Thatch Hewitt, the stroker. No, why not call it what it is? It's a relief to finally say it. I'm only sorry you had to be the one to hear it, to bear the burden of this hideous secret. Well, aren't you going to say anything? Or are you so repulsed that... What? 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 Not you too, Chessie. Not another tormented soul. Not tormented. Happy? You and me. Make a go of it. Chessie, don't be absurd. How could we possibly be happy together? I daren't show my face in half of London. New York? Yes. New York. But what would we live on? I've no talent, no skills. What, sell this old stuff? It's nothing but a bunch of... antiques. Oh, but would they let people like us sell antiques? You're right. Someone's got to try. Oh, Chessie, I'm so... What do you mean, more than stroking? You repulse me! Oh, no, don't go! I can learn.
So Clive goes to New York.
Clive goes to New York and starts the antique business.
Like no others before him.
Like no others before him, and starts a long reign of tortured antique dealers.
Well, Clive goes to New York. He can become who he really is.
That's right.
In New York, you come from Wisconsin. Have you found out who you really are?
Well, it seems I found out that I'm several people, for judging from the show.
Well, a good many of your characters, well, I won't say they're women, I will say they wear dresses. And there was a time when the only way a man could play a woman's role was in drag.
Right.
That's not exactly true. That's not exactly true now. Where do you see, what do you see happening here?
Where I fall in there? I think that there's just, I mean, first of all, I mean, I don't know how many of your listeners would know of Charles Ludlum. I mean, he certainly opened the door, for those of you who don't know. He,
The Ridiculous Theater Company,
which he founded, and really brought men playing women's roles, not in a drag context, into the public eye. I mean, he's really the first one who caught the attention of the New York Times. And through his, like I say, the Times gave it a certain legitimacy that it didn't have before, where men could play a woman's role without the usual drag context, like I say, lip-syncing or doing Judy Garland or Barbra Streisand or the traditional drag things. That, like I say, there was a certain legitimacy granted to the fact that men could play a woman's role as a woman without any sort of, though he certainly had his camp moments, which is not to say I don't, but that it wasn't primarily just a camp phenomenon, that it really could be looked at, like I say, as a legitimate form, almost like those Japanese guys. Or in England, it's certainly a tradition of, you know, men playing women's roles that we've, in a sense, made it an American form as well.
Well, a lot of your characters are women.
Actually, I was breaking it down one day. At this show, I've got it sort of half and half. There are 5 men and 5 women. So maybe I'm also making some comment on the yin and yang of of human nature, though I don't even know how much I believe in that. With me, it actually just sort of came by accident. I mean, that some of the ideas I had were for women characters. The nun was just a character that came from real life, from my grade school experience. Barbie came about just because, actually, when I wrote the piece, it was Barbie's 20-somethingth anniversary, so there was a lot of material around about her. And I just became fascinated with the idea, really, about the public's fascination with star figures at the end of their career, Judy Garland late in her career, Janis Joplin late in her career, when they are on stage at their worst, that we have some sort of, actually The Rose had just come out, and there was all this hoopla about, you know, Bette Midler playing this Janis Joplin figure, and it made me think about our fascination with, and for some reason, I think, particularly women who are at the end of the line, and I thought it would be very funny if Barbie were at the end of her line, and it never really occurred to me until I was really in interview experiences like this that it was even considered a drag performance, whatever, I guess because it was a doll and a nun. I never even thought of them as having any sort of real sexuality.
Can you give us a little bit of Barbie?
Okay, when she's talking about Ken, just to give you a little lead into it, Barbie's talking about the troubles you run into once you open a nightclub. Once you open a nightclub, suddenly everybody's got an act. Oh, Ken. Ugh, he is so plastic. I mean, he does like this really slick Wayne Newton thing that is just pathetic. Well, I told him right there at the audition, right in front of everyone. I said, Ken, face it, you'll always be Mr. Barbie. Well, he just goes out in a huff. Then, when I got back to the Barbie Dreamhouse, there was this note. It says, Barbie, I hope the club's a big success, since that's the only thing that means anything to you. But remember, Barbie, there's more to life than being able to bend at the waist. If you should ever need to get in touch with me, I've moved in with Midge. My best friend. Best friend, my ass.
Poor Barbie.
Poor Barbie.
My guest is Jeffrey Essman, actor, performer, writer. His show in New York is called Artificial Reality at the Perry Street Theater in New York. This is Fresh Air. Jeffrey Essman is my guest, actor, performer, performance specialist in New York. A little bit of your act, of course, comes from Wisconsin, and, you know, Wisconsin, where wives take their husbands out for a walk after dinner.
Right.
How much is the boy from Wisconsin still informing the performer in New York?
Oh, I think very much in a way. In a way, the whole show, I think, is about Wisconsin, because the fact is that there was not a lot to do there. I mean, it's a very pretty state and very quiet, and it's perfect for a quiet suburban sort of living. But, I mean, when I think of back to the way I played when I was a kid and stuff, it was constantly play acting, you know, playing a character, playing a part, reenacting a movie one of my friends had seen or I had seen or something. And that's one of the things I like about the show that people have commented on, and it's certainly something I don't know whether I consciously put in there, but I think subconsciously it's drifted in, and that there's a certain playfulness to it, that I've always wanted to keep the sense to the show that it was really sort of a couple kids playing around in the basement, that you do grab a couple party hats and become a Barbie doll, and then you grab a couple t-shirts and become a nun, and then you throw a shawl on and you become this, and you just grab a jacket and become Clive. That it has that sense of being this, you know, bored little kid out in the Midwest who was endlessly entertaining himself through these very long winters. So I think in that sense, the show is very informed by Wisconsin.
Hmm. So how did you get to the work that you're doing now? I mean, you call it performance theater. Others might have called it a one-man show, I suppose.
Right. I mean, I really just consider myself, I still don't know what performance art is supposed to be. I really just consider myself a writer-actor. And it is. It's monologues, or it's theater to my mind. I mean, that's my training. That's the reason I came here. The way I drifted into this end of it was actually back in 1978. I had a teacher at HB Studio. Actually, it was an improvisation teacher I had who was watching my improvs in class and collared me afterwards and kept suggesting that I could write these down and repeat them. And I got very nervous about that. And I said, oh, no, I'll, you know, there's, for one thing, there was no such scene that exists now as far as alternative spaces or whatever you want to call them, a downtown performance scene. At that time, you either performed in the comedy clubs or the theater or in cabaret, which is eventually what I ended up doing once I had a show together. But at any rate, it was through the encouragement and the nudging, really, of this teacher that I finally, in 1978, agreed that I would at least buy a notebook so that if I had an idea, I could write it down. So my New Year's resolution was to buy this notebook, and by February, I had written my first piece, and by August, I had done my first 45-minute one-man show. So it really was really just through this one sort of mentor that I got nudged into doing solo performance.
Lily Tomlin has been important to you.
Oh, very much, yeah. First of all, just to know that there's somebody out there who's doing it. Also, the things I've just learned from watching her perform, listening to her, in this case, it's probably Jane Wagner should be given credit because the writing is so good in Lily's pieces also. And also just because she turned on to another onto another major influence, which was Ruth Draper. I had read an article, an interview with Lily Tomlin when they asked her who her influences were, and she mentioned Ruth Draper, and I ran up to the Lincoln Center Library and took out all of Ruth Draper's albums, taped them all, and listened to them hour after hour, just because they're wonderful, wonderful material. And just what I had learned from the writing, specifically from Ruth Draper, if you know her work, she has a marvelous sense in her writing and her performance that not only do you get to know the character she's playing, but in most of her situations, she's either at a party or some sort of social situation where she'll be talking to anywhere up to 6, maybe even 10 people, picking up the phone, talking to someone across the room, doing a side to the maid. And you not only know her character, but through the writing, you also know exactly what the other people are like and what their response is to her material. So I would have to say that those are really the two major influences of Ruth Draper and Lily Tomlin.
Hmm. A fair amount of your work has to do with sex, and it has to do with Catholicism.
Right.
Do you get in trouble?
In which sense? No, I don't get in trouble at all. I mean, as far as the audience, first of all, seems very willing to go into those areas with me. And actually, I mean, I am Catholic. I have priest friends even. In fact, the pastor of my parish came and saw the show last weekend, and he waited for me after the show. And he was actually worried because he had read the reviews about the nun piece, and he saw the picture of me performing the nun. And he had told me at Mass one Sunday that, you know, he was worried about that I was doing this anti-Catholic diatribe or something. And when you see the piece, it really has nothing to do with being anti-Catholic or anti-religion. It's really just a character piece. It's about the fear and the humor that I found in this nun.
Now tell us about this nun.
The nun is based, I should explain, it's one of the characters that's based on a real-life person, actually two real-life people. Just historically, I should mention that the parish I went to in Milwaukee, the parish school, the grade school, was the last stop for this particular order of nuns. It was a very cushy, rich parish. So this was sort of a gift to them before they were sent back to the mother house for retirement and heaven, that they could teach at this school. So we got all the very, very oldest nuns. In fact, one of the ones, the fourth grade teacher that this is based on, was so old at the time I had her that she only taught in the morning. And in the afternoon, we were given a young one. So this piece is actually what I call a cross character, and I've taken the physical life, actually, the quavering hand and most of the vocal tricks from the fourth grade one, and some of the stories. For example, there's a story in which that Sister Bernice tells about a little boy who kept feeding the elephants at the zoo pebbles, and he did this for some length of time until finally one day, for some reason, he bought them real peanuts, but by the time he had bought them real peanuts, the elephants figured they were pebbles, and they tore off both his arms, which gets a big laugh, which it should, I guess. But this is a real story that actually my eighth grade nun told us at least 3 or 4 times during the year. She was so senile at that point, she, of course, would forget that she had told it to us, and would say, did I ever tell you the elephant story? And we'd say, no, sister. And so we got to hear this 4 or 5 times through the year. It just became one of our favorite stories. So that's, like I say, a cross character between those two.
Is you suppose Sister Berenice is lurking somewhere around the studio this morning?
I think her spirit is with us. Actually, the eighth grade one, my sister sent me a notice that she had seen in the local newspaper that that nun had finally died, and she was, I think, 107 years old or something, but well over 100 by the time she had died. So we did some subtraction, and by the time I had her, she had to have been at least in her 80s. So we were dealing with, you know, the really old ones.
Do you think you could bring her to the mic for a moment?
I would be glad to bring her to the mic. Boys and girls, it's hard to be good, I know that. You know, but there is a way of making it seem less difficult. Every day, when you wake up, boys and girls, just say to yourself, I'm going to die today. Then see how you behave.
Why do I think that you didn't make that one up either?
No, that is not made up either. That's good advice. That's good nun's advice.
Why do you call the show Artificial Reality?
Well, we had I think every show goes through this, unless it's very clear. Just finding a title for the show. And we went through lists and days and, you know, throwing titles back and forth. And finally, I must give credit to my press agent, Jim Baldessari, that he came up with the idea. It was, if you know what artificial reality is now called virtual reality, I think, but it's this new computer toy where they're creating realities just by putting on some sort of headset and a glove or something like that. And we thought it was a clever title and that it actually fit what it is I do on stage, that I am creating these little realities with each of the characters, that there's not a through line in the sense, I'm not trying to say all these characters exist in a certain club or anything like that, that each character has its own setting, its own particular time frame, and that it is its own reality. Beyond that, and this is purely by accident since we came up with the title arbitrarily, I think that when you look at the characters, each of them has their own artificial reality as well, other than one that's being played. I mean, Barbie's reality about doomed show business, Bernice's reality about punishment and this angry God constantly watching you. Each of the characters have a reality inside their head, which is, I think, what the audience is laughing about, too.
My guest has been Jeffrey Yesman. His show in New York right now is called Artificial Reality. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air.